Greetings and salutations, everyone. Welcome to my podcast. I am Dr. Harold C. Connolly, Jr., explorer of space and time and the human experience. And I do so in very specific ways. First, as founding chair and professor of the Department of Geology at Rowan University in Glassboro, New Jersey, and also as COI, a mission sample scientist of OSIRIS-REx, NASA's asteroid sample return mission, and COI of Hayabusa 2, JAXA's asteroid sample return mission. Science cannot and does not live in a vacuum. And that is part of the major theme of this podcast, is to discuss science and educate about what the natural physical sciences are, which is what I mean when I say science, and how scientists are humans and have a wealth of experience that they bring into performing their science and, of course, living their lives. And today I'm very, very pleased and happy to be here in the University of Hawaii at Manoa with my good friend and colleague, Gary Huss. Hello, Gary. Thanks for agreeing to be on my podcast.
Hello, Harold, and hello, everyone.
So I've been working with Gary now off and on a different project since 1996, actually, when I went to Caltech as a postdoc. Mm-hmm. And then here at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, as well as when you were at ASU, too. The theme of this particular podcast, I thought about because of you, Gary, and because of what I think is really a unique history of science that you have experienced, particularly our science, cosmochemistry and meteoritics. One of the issues that is important is continuity through time, especially when it comes to the human equation. And for us in the world of academics, traditionally we impart to our students what we have learned from our teachers and, of course, our own experiences. And that's how we pass down this kind of information. But you have the great privilege and uniqueness of being born into meteoritics.
True.
Your grandfather was one of the founding members of our science.
Yes, he. My grandfather was Hyrie Nininger, and he was. He started out as a biologist. He saw a great event in the sky in 1923. He was walking home from work, and a meteor flew over, a big one. And he looked at it and said, "I'm going to go find that." And so he took some time off, followed the direction that the meteor went, asked a lot of people if they'd seen it, tracked down where it ended, looked for the meteorite, and didn't find it. But he found another one.
Oh! I'm not sure I ever heard this story then.
So that convinced him that there must be more meteorites than people had thought about before, since, you know, can't find this one. I know where it went, but there's another one sitting right here. So he decided over the next 3 or 4 years that he should try to figure out how many meteorites were falling and where they were, and he would go look for them. And of course, everybody told him that was the stupidest idea anybody had ever come up with, because I can't remember which guy, it was either the head of the Smithsonian at the time or the head of the Field Museum, said, "Young man, if you spend your whole life wandering around looking for meteorites, you will never find even one."
That's amazing.
And of course, he only found around 250 falls over the course of his career.
Oh, that's it, huh? Okay.
5,000 specimens or something like that.
Right, right, right.
So, clearly, somebody had it wrong.
Right. He actually left his academic job for this as well.
Yeah, he stayed as a biology professor for another 3 or 4 years, but then in the middle of the Depression, decided he didn't need a real job and he would go do this.
Wow. When you think about that, I mean, that decision in of itself is sort of visionary, or was for him. It worked out that way anyway.
Yeah. Well, at some level, this is where one of your things about people being involved. He was always a little bit naive about the way the world worked.
Mm.
And his wife was the one who kept the ship afloat.
Oh, all right. Okay.
And so at some level, he didn't realize what he was doing, I think. And it did work out. But even in hindsight, you look back and you say, how could you possibly have done that? You have right. three small children. You have a job. You're going to quit your job in the middle of the Depression and go find meteorites and do what?
Right. Do what? Right, right. I think it's important to point out to the listeners that there are many different kinds of problems in science, physical, natural sciences we're discussing here, but also social sciences. But there are many different kinds of problems and different ways of studying those problems. And you and I are both sample scientists, and that we right. need to have our samples. We have to have the rocks to study. And the rocks we study are meteorites. These are the remnants of the earliest stages of the formation of the Earth-like planets. In fact, gives us the age of the solar system. Chondrites, 4.567 billion years old. There are stardust grains in these meteorites known as chondrites, which you have studied your whole career.
Mm-hmm.
And are actually were formed before our solar system was actually created. And so the listeners know, both Gary and I are geologists as well, and rocks are books. And they tell a story about when they formed, how they formed, where they have been, how they've changed. And the pages of those books are minerals. And we read those pages of the books to tell the story. So let me ask you a question then, in a sense that your history is really interesting as far as how you got to where you are now, having been raised in a family that was one of the founding fathers as a member of the Meteoritical Society, one of the founding fathers of the Meteoritical Society. They were collectors and dealers as well, scientists, all wrapped up into one, arguably something that's a little bit unique in today's world. And is there something that your grandfather sort of, or your father and your mother as well, being in the same line of work, that imparted on you that you find you're here where you are today at the University of Hawaii at Manoa because of?
Well, there's a couple of different lines that led to where I am now.
Because you also worked for a oil company for a while.
Yeah, that was kind of an aside where I was having a midlife crisis and trying to decide what I'm going to do with my life.
Okay.
But you know, I grew up with meteorites in the house, in the basement of a meteorite museum for a few years.
Mm.
I worked with my dad collecting meteorites. Basically, the strategy for collecting meteorites is you go to a farming community, and the farmers go out and go over all of their land at least three or four times a year. So
of course.
That's much more efficient than you going out trying to walk all over their land. So you tell them what meteorites look like and offer to buy them if they find them, and you'd be surprised how many of them bring the rocks back to the house instead of leaving them out in the middle of the field when they when they find them.
Right.
And so that's the basis for the Nininger Huss Field Program over 50 years.
Oh, right.
That turned up about a quarter of the meteorites known at the time that they ended in about 1990.
Quite a cutting-edge technique.
Right as the Antarctic meteorites started really pouring in and the desert meteorites started pouring in.
Right, we both lived through that, yeah.
And
yeah,
so, you know, we went for where 500 meteorites was a big deal, which is what they kind of collected together, to 60,000 meteorites, so 500 meteorites doesn't matter. I mean, a little bit now, it did at that
noise
point.
Noise in the background, yeah, right. Yeah.
But it did at that point.
Right.
So I had that experience, but both my dad and my grandfather made their living by selling the meteorites to either the institutions who worked on them, the Smithsonian or people in Europe or the Field Museum or Caltech or whatever,
right.
and to private collectors who just like meteorites because they're fun.
Right.
And there has always been resistance to amongst scientists to selling meteorites to collectors because they're fun, because those guys aren't going to do anything important with them.
Yes, we've discussed this before. Agreed. You and I have the same kind of view on this thing, right?
Well, but that's not true, because what they do that's important is they become interested in the objects. They become interested in the science that's going into the objects. Of course they do. They may or may not be able to do the science themselves, although some people, including one of your students, Devin Schrader, started out as a collector as a child.
Right.
He found some meteorites himself.
Right.
Then he became a meteorite scientist.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, you're planting the seed corn, essentially, to get these guys interested. But because of the resistance to this idea of giving meteorites to regular people, there was always this sense of otherness that I and my family felt when dealing with the professional scientists, because obviously you're not a professional scientist, you're selling meteorites. But you know, there's two sides to that too. They did science, they published papers.
Your grandfather published papers as well. I told that, yeah.
And you know, one of the things that drove me was the pure interest in the science, but there was this funny sense that I needed to show the world that the Hussteininger lineage wasn't second class.
I see. Yes, okay. Yes.
And so then I went to college, and then I went to graduate school, and studied meteorites. The details of what I studied were kind of odd, but kind of off track. That had to do with my bizarre way of looking at the universe. But in the end, I ended up working in all of those, essentially all of the U.S. major labs that were doing cosmic chemistry, and was able to be successful in those labs, which essentially got me past that part, where I had to show that I could actually do it.
Your 85 paper, I remember reading matrix, your paper on matrix and chondrites. I remember reading that as a senior and graduate student. Was so impressed with that paper. I still remember it to this day. Yeah, I have a signed copy for you.
I guess you do.
Yeah.
So that was fun, and then once I had basically demonstrated to myself that I was capable of doing science, then I could sort of relax and do science.
Well, I don't think either one of us really relax anymore, but yeah, we try. Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah. Well, you raise a point I want to touch upon a little bit more is the relationship between entrepreneurs and scientists. And of course, some scientists are also entrepreneurs. But as we discussed, we can't do our science without having the samples. And, you know, the generosity of meteorite entrepreneurs can be really amazing. I mean, I think of two groups that I know very intimately well, the Kilgores, Marvin and Kitty, and Mike Farmer, who never hesitate to give to science, especially when it's some unusual or important new find. I mean, Mike Farmer gets on an airplane and goes when there's been a fall, your grandfather did, and goes wherever he has to go to get the finds. And that's an important relationship.
Well, and they're fundamentally interested in the science. That's what's driving them.
Yes, agreed.
They're trying to learn what you can about each of these rocks. And that's one thing maybe we should digress for just a second.
Sure.
Because why do we want these rocks? Basically, the fundamental underpinning of sample science is that there is a natural world universe out there that we can learn about by making observations of samples.
Mm. Yes.
We don't start out knowing the answer. We start out knowing the question.
Right.
And the samples provide the answer.
Agreed.
So it's always part of the process to find new samples that provide new information about this reality that we're trying to understand. And there are new techniques that are involved in measuring the new samples and the old samples to try to improve our understanding of this reality that we're trying to find. And so the bottom line is that reality. Now, people are involved in science, and some people can get very invested in their pet idea about what this reality is.
Very diplomatic way of putting it, yes.
And so there is when you learn that human beings aren't the perfect scientists all the time.
Right.
And you end up having very interesting discussions at meetings where people stand up and yell at each other about how stupid each one is.
Well, we've seen that, haven't we, more than once.
And often in the end, what you come up with is they were both partly right.
Fair enough, fair enough. I mean, you and I are of the age where we can remember Anders and Wasserberg going at it in public. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, that's a very good point you raise. And the human equation in doing science, which many scientists would claim is an unbiased way of looking at a problem or some kind of reality to figure out and solve, is, of course, incorrect. Because by nature, we are humans, and we can't take bias out of anything.
That's right. But the difference between a scientific approach and many other ways of thinking about the world, not all, but many others, is that there is an underlying reality. And what I think
right.
does not change the reality.
Right.
It may change the argument at the moment,
right.
but it does not change the reality.
Right.
And if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. And there's it doesn't matter how much I yell about it or
right,
how many people
right.
I pay off or whatever, I'm right. still wrong.
Well, right. And, you know, through the course of time in these podcasts, and hopefully if I ever get around to trying to get a publisher of my book, too, the important point, especially in today's world, I think it's always been that way, but right now in the climate of the U.S. with science being attacked as it is, you know, there's no problem between science and religion, for example. It doesn't exist other than in people's minds, because you cannot. Religion is about a belief. And when students tell me science is about seeking the truth, well, so is religion, but in a different way.
Yeah, they don't ask the same questions.
They don't ask the same questions, correct. So they're the same coin, but different sides.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the current misunderstanding of what science is, particularly physical and natural sciences, stems from that particular issue that they don't understand that we could never disprove God exists or doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. We would never try. So there is no problem with science and religion, first of all. And second, I think the other issue is a lot of people don't want their lifestyle to change and think that science is attempting to do that sometimes, but they have their cell phones, they have their Viagra, their cold medicine, their new cars. I mean, all this stems from science. I mean, we have the technology we have today in part because of the Apollo space program.
Yeah.
You know? What has been one of the highlights for you being here at University of Hawaii at Manoa? I mean, you have one of the world-class analytical facilities here downstairs in the basement that I've used many times. I'm curious. I have a thought, but I would like to hear from you.
Well, I'm not quite sure what direction you want me to go.
Any direction that makes you happy and tells the truth.
The opportunity to come here and set up my own laboratory was not something that I really expected to happen.
I remember that, yes.
And
much like me going to Rome. Yeah, right.
And so when I was given the opportunity, and especially when it turned out in the job search that there were two of us who were highly qualified for the position, and we succeeded in hiring both of us. Kazu was also in the
that I didn't know. That's okay.
Market for
that
the
makes
job.
Sense. Yeah, that makes sense.
It gave us a really, really good basis for setting up a lab. I knew a lot about making measurements with an ion probe. Kazu knew a lot about making ion probes.
Right.
And
hardware.
And yeah. science.
Yeah.
So it was a good match. And then at that time, the technology had reached a point where you could buy something off the shelf that did most of what you wanted to do, and you could modify it to get completely where you wanted to.
That's a very good point. Yes, that's a very good point.
10 years earlier, it was 8 years earlier when I went to Arizona State, we chose not to buy the kind of ion probe we bought here because it wasn't mature, and we didn't have the skill set to make it mature.
Right, okay.
So we got here a mature instrument with somebody who could help push it even beyond where it was.
Right.
Which we did. And since that time, we've been able to do a lot of very exciting science, making measurements that couldn't be made before,
right.
opening understandings that we didn't have before, changing the view of how we think the solar system works. And the change in the overall conception of the early solar system has been rather dramatic in the last decade.
It has been. That's absolutely correct. I agree with that statement. That's an important statement you just made. I actually also think that one of the more important things that have come out of creating this state-of-the-art lab here at University of Hawaii in Manoa is the place that Hawaii holds in the world physically and culturally. It's a real bridge between the East and West.
It is.
And you have scientists from both sides of the world, East and West, coming from all over the place to use your facility and bring their rich cultural experiences and heritage here to learn and also teach from those experiences the general populace. And, you know, that is a marvelous thing.
Yeah,
something that is as important to me as knowing more about how the solar system actually physically works.
Well, that's true. Yeah. And you're absolutely correct. We get people from, if I start on the eastern rim of the Pacific, I mean the western rim of the Pacific and go east.
Right.
We've had people from Singapore and Taiwan and Australia and Japan. And in the old days before it was illegal, from China.
Right.
And we've also had people from all over the United States, and we have people coming from Europe.
Right.
Some of the major institutions in Europe send their people.
Right.
And all of these people come with something they have in mind that they want to do and they want to measure. In many cases, it's something we've never done before. So they're coming and they're challenging
us. That's a great challenge, yes, right.
To make a set of measurements that nobody's ever made. And we're one of the few places that you can do that because the way we're set up, we're not required to run a factory that turns out large numbers of analyses of a particular type in order to stay alive. So we can take the time to try to measure something different and to do something interesting.
Right.
And this is more or less intentional, but that the side effect is that we're kind of a smaller operation than many of the other operations in the world.
Well, yes, but that clearly doesn't matter. I wouldn't say smaller, I'd say more focused in a different way. I mean, that's
more focused in random directions.
Well, yes, but it's in part the people who help drive that focus. Mm-hmm. The people who want to come here and work and the problems that they bring with them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not all glamorous. People think, good, you're going to Hawaii, fantastic. Well, sure, of course. But
yeah, we bring them to Hawaii. We put them in a room in the basement with no windows and we don't let them out.
And it's 68 degrees Fahrenheit in the middle of Hawaii. More than one occasion I've gotten sick from working down there, so cold, and get out. It's like, oh my God. But then again, it is Hawaii. So, I mean, you know. There are advantages to that as well. Yeah. So the I guess the last thing I'd like to touch on briefly with you as a scientist is, what or how has this experience, your life, meaning this experience, your life in Hawaii, coming to Hawaii, changed your views of science, if it has?
Well, that's an interesting question, which of course has many layers to it. My fundamental view of science and what it can provide to our culture and how you carry it out has not changed. I have gained a much more nuanced appreciation of how interacting with different people in different parts of society, including government, where we get our funding, influences what you can and cannot do. The political situation is something completely different, which really didn't have anything to do with me in Hawaii.
Well, we shouldn't go there. We will someday.
but it's actually a bit of a challenge to, well, it could be a bit of a challenge, depending on how you view the science in the first place, to avoid compromising what you really want to do or how you really want to do it in order to be successful in the world as it exists at the moment. Because we need to get research grants in order to carry out our funding.
Well, that's right.
And the money has gotten tighter.
Science requires money to do it.
It's getting tighter. And so you're in a competition with people for money. And you can end up modifying what it is that you're proposing to do because you think it has a better chance of getting money, not because you care whether you do it or not. And that starts to become very unfortunate. And unfortunately, I think it's happening more than it used to.
So this is kind of affecting the creative process,
mm-hmm.
which is the art of our life in science, is being creative.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think that's something people don't appreciate in general, that as a scientist, we're also artists in our own way.
Basically, you get certain pieces of information out of your instrument, numbers or descriptions or whatever, and then you use the same part of your brain that you would actually use to create a painting or a novel or something, to essentially put these pieces together into a story.
That's right. Well said. Well articulate. Yes, agreed. Yeah.
And those who are good at it are able to make a story that honors all of the observations and recognizes where the observations are lacking, which therefore defines where you're going to go next in
trying to do some work.
And yet still produces an overarching framework for what you're thinking about so that you can design your experiments and look for things. Those who aren't so good at it can grab onto two or three facts and build the most beautiful inverted pyramid you had ever seen that explains the entire universe, but...
Yes, we know how that happens. I know who does it too.
Yeah. So anyway,
well, that was actually was a beautiful expression of science and art right there. And at that statement you just made, I want to thank you very much for participating in my podcast. I really appreciate it, especially right now in a climate in the U.S. where science is being threatened from many different angles and for many different reasons. It's important for people to know that we are also human. Mm-hmm. As they say in Hawaii, mahalo.
Mahalo.